Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome. Hope all are doing well and healthy and enjoying the nice weather, going for walks. Okay, so we last week, of course, we had a talk on Shavuos on Thursday, but we'll continue. We're towards the end of the first parak, so maybe, please God, we'll finish the first parak in Perkei Avot today. So we'll start. That's the new cycle. Anyway, the minhag, as we mentioned, was originally to learn Perkei Avot between Pesach and Shavuot. There are only five chapters in Perkei Avot, really, so the sixth chapter, Shanu Chachamim Bilshon HaMishnah. The rabbis taught in the language of the Mishnah, and that is, of course, all about receiving of the Torah, the 48 ways for Torah, because that would be done on the Shabbat before the holiday of Shavuot, which, of course, becomes the holiday we celebrate the receiving of the Torah. And then the minhag developed to continue Perkei Avot till Rosh Hashanah, all in the summer. It's a beautiful minhag, of course, very appropriate, and a long summer afternoon. So please, God, will continue. And as we say, we're not doing like, you know, one parak one week. We just continue from the beginning, and we'll get how far as we get. Before we go back to Perkei Avot, I just want to say a few words on Dr. Lam, Dr. Norman Lam, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha. I'm sure everybody, I don't know how many people online actually met him or knew him, but I'll just mention very few brief things. I encourage you to read about him, to watch the memorials about him, to you know, see some of his works, but he was really Ish Eshkolot, as we saw, a person of many, many talents, a Talmud Chacham, an academic scholar, a great orator, a communal rabbi, of course, a president, a fundraiser, many, many, you know, qualities, and of course, really the leading spokesperson for, I would say, our community, modern centrist orthodoxy, whatever you want to define it. I'll just mention the first time I heard him speak, as far as I can recall, was when I first came to Yeshiva University in 1980. So they had a, you know, what they called, you know, club hour on Thursdays. They had like, 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock, I guess. So we'd have club hour. And so every week they had different things going on. So I remember it was Parshat Noach. So right after Yontif and my first year in YU, and Dr. Lam, the president, was giving a talk, so I went to listen. So he was on Parsha Noach, so he spoke on the pasuk of Tzemin HaTeva, that God tells Noach, after he's cooped up in the ark for a year, he says, go, it's time to leave. So Dr. Lam wondered, what kind of, who, why do you have to tell us this? You know, after, listen, we know the feeling of cooped up, and we're not cooped up in an ark, and it's been only 3 months. And people, you know, are itching to get out. People can't stand being locked in somewhere. So you would think Noah would run out of the ark the first second before he could run out of the ark, when the waters are still deep, even if the animals didn't come back, the birds didn't come back. And yet he had to be told to leave the ark, because apparently Noah didn't leave the ark. He, it's not hard to understand why. After what happened, the world is destroyed, at least, you know, and to rebuild is very hard. It's next to impossible, and Noah couldn't, it was too hard. And he just said, forget it, I give up on life, and I'm going to stay in the ark. And God, of course, told him, no, you have to build. And in a sense, it wasn't so successful. Noah gets drunk, it was hard. We can't blame him. He's still in Ich Tzaddik, Tamimei Abedorta, but God had to tell him to leave the ark. And of course, Dr. Lam, of course, said that this is sort of our mission at Yeshiva University, at Tzemin HaTeva. We have to leave the ark sometimes of the Torah, of the Beit Midrash. We have to go out into the world and make our mark. A teva can be a beautiful thing, but there's a time we have Tzemin HaTeva. So that was just the first time I heard him speak, as I think everybody heard. He was a riveting speaker, really, just share that one thought with you. And it's very coincidental. There's no coincidences. There are coincidences. Just on Sunday, we were cleaning up a little bit in our study, and we came across a letter from Norman Lam that in 2004, the early years of Torah in Motion, Dr. Lam, we invited him to speak in Toronto. He spoke on a couple panels, can watch it actually on, we have it of course in our tape library or whatever, MP3 library, and just totally coincidental, like 2-3 hours after we found out he had passed away, he read a letter, he just wrote a short letter thanking us for inviting him to Toronto. I thought that was a very sort of moving idea. You know, after he came back to New York, he wrote thank you. So anyway, to just want to mention that, it's still the week of Shiva for him. Okay. Okay, we're in the middle, or we finished the 15th Mishnah, that's Shammai Omer, but I want to come back to an idea that the Eretz Yisrael says, Asei Torah Tchakva, make your Torah permanent. Your Torah should be your focus, you know, Kavata Itim L'Torah, we know that's the, Talmud says, is the second question God asked you at 120, when you go up to Shammayim. The second question is, did you set aside time for the study of Torah? Most people know. The first question is, Nasata Venatata Be'emuna. How honest were you in your business dealings? If you're not honest, nothing else matters. If you're a crook, a crook is a harsh word. If you cheat a little here and there, you're not Be'emuna. So what's use is the learning of the Torah, but Asei Torah Tchakva, make your Torah permanent. So I just want to point out that the Tiferet Yisrael, he always has fascinating comments. Tiferet Yisrael mentioned lived in the 19th century, probably in the classical, before the Kahati came around, and he changed how we learned Mishnah. Pinchas Kahati, of course, a banker in Israel, taught Mishnayos in the 1-4 break when banks were used to be closed in the afternoon, and he was so good, people told him to write it down. He sent it to the soldiers in the army, and of course, most people today, when they study Mishnayos, use a Kahati. I even have the app on my phone, and it's Hebrew and English, the Kahati. But before the Kahati, people used the Yachin of Boaz Mishnah, like in the Shulchan Aruch, you know, the classical Mefarshim, the Bartanur, the Tosfot Yontiv, and those are medieval commentaries. And Tiberji has a little bit more modern. He has a lot of modern ideas. He throws in a lot of concepts. So he has a five-part definition that says he finds, what does it mean to say Torah Chakva? It's sort of an educational philosophy or educational pedagogy. How does one make their Torah permanent? So I just go through it a little bit. So the number one thing he starts off, the Torah is keva. We have to focus when we learn, we have to be learning. So I mentioned this because, in other words, and he says, you shouldn't be lying down when you learn, like, you know, relax. You shouldn't be eating, sort of all the things we all do today. You know, we have, I remember in the YU Beit Midrash, that was actually very interesting. YU Beit Midrash, people used to eat in the Beit Midrash. There you go. You're technically allowed to eat in a Beit Midrash. You're not allowed to eat in a shul. That's the difference in a Beit Knesset and a Beit Midrash. But very often, like the morning Seder would start officially at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they had various minyanim in the morning. But the most popular minyan was the 8:15 minyan, what they called the executive minyan. No, you daven an 8:15 minyan, and you're serious. You finish davening at 8:52. So you don't have time to eat breakfast. So you run across the Beit Midrash. So people would pick up a muffin, a cup of coffee, and sit in the Beit Midrash. I don't think he means that. I don't know what he means. But the idea, of course, that one has to be very focused on learning. And then he says something we all know in the old tradition, you should learn out loud. So he says, not only, of course, it helps when you say things out loud, you remember it much better, of course, but also it banishes other thoughts. That's what he says. You know, if you're talking about something, you're sitting there thinking, all kinds of things enter your mind. When you're talking, that's a little harder to know. We know that the Gemara in Megillah says you have to learn Torah with a song, Bizimra. With joy, when we sing, we're happy. Torah, it makes us happy. Yivduah Hashem b'simcha, it's a beautiful. And we sing, and you know, if we go to a Beit Midrash, you'll sometimes hear people are sort of humming as they learn, and there's the traditional sort of nusach of learning. It's, I guess, a little out of style in modern schools, but it's there's a lot to be said for it. And we know that when we sing, we say things out loud, we do remember it, and especially if we sing, you know, try to say Shir HaMalot out by heart. Everybody here probably knows Shir HaMalot by heart. I don't know if everybody could do it so well if they don't sing it. Everybody can sing it by heart. I'm not sure you can say it by heart. Or Ashrei, you know, you learn the song. So that's what he says, to make keva, Torah Chakva. In other words, this is what we're focusing on. This is the permanent thing we're doing. We're not lying down. We're not relaxed. You know, of course, it is wonderful to learn Torah, you know, in the car and then tapes. That's all good. But there is something, there's a lot of truth to this. That's great, but you're not going to develop into a Torah scholar if, you know, by listening, driving to work and all these things that you have to really work hard. I mentioned before how Nechama Leibowitz didn't allow tape recorders in her class, and she insisted you come every single week or you didn't come. It's not, as she's told us, it's not a country club. You come to her shiur every single week. You commit to the beginning of the year, or she doesn't want you coming because it's kva. It's permanent. Okay. The second thing he writes is he compares the word kva to minucha, to minucha, which he defines like it should be pleasant, lanuach. It's sort of almost sounds like the opposite of what we just said. But what he explains it, it means you have to have a nice place to learn. Has to have windows. I'm assuming he's writing in the mid-1800s. We know what some of the conditions of these schools were like in all places. You know, some one room in the middle of who knows where, unhygienic. Naomi Stephen was talking about that on Wednesday night in her fasting talk, the founding of Beis Yaakov, how the early Beis Yaakovs were very poor conditions. And no light, no windows, etc., crowded. So, no, you want to learn, you need a nice Beis Medrash, a nice place. People have a comfortable seat. And he writes a nice book with good printing. Again, this is 1800s, and it's true. I even look at the books I bought, all the Sfarim I bought. You know, my kids, for their bar mitzvahs, but they get the newer versions of the same books, some of them, and it's like the printing is so much better. You know, it's clearer, and block printing, and footnotes, and all these things. If you want to learn, you need to have good books and good printing. Very interesting, and that's, of course, the modern style. Then he says, kva, say Torah, kva, kva, make your Torah however you want. You know, permanent, or but he says kva means continuity. Yeah, that's what I said on the Chamalivu. It's got to be, you can't take constant breaks. You got to learn every day or once a week, whatever. You have a keva time. That's the way we normally understand it. Say Torah keva, make a permanent time that nothing interrupts with that time except a wedding or, God forbid, a funeral. You have all these halachas when you can break learning. That's the assumption is that a person has a set time. He never misses learning at that time. So if he has a wedding, then he's allowed and obligated to miss learning. But so you have to have continuity, regularity. And interesting what he says is to have continuity, you can't learn too many subjects. You can't, like, you know, 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, a taste of everything. You want to learn Mishnah and Talmud and Machshava and Tanakh and philosophy and Jewish history. It doesn't work. So he says you have to limit yourself to a maximum of 3 topics a day. I just find that very interesting that when you learn, you know, focus, read one book, finish the book, and move on to another book. Sometimes people, I know I find that hard sometimes. I can't believe you get older, you know, it's hard to focus so much. So you go from one subject to subject. But we know that the people who are excellent learners, they can focus. They can sit there for hours. You know, when I was 18 and sitting and learning in Shiva, I could sit in the Beis Medrash for 12 hours a day straight. I can't do that anymore. That's a whole different, but that's, you have to be continuous and not all over the place, focused on one place. And then he says, well, make it strong. So you have to make sure, you know, you understand what you look strong and clear. Don't move on to the next subject till you understand the first subject. You know, very often I sort of understand, and we all know when he says this, we all know, if you can't say over what you learned, you don't really understand it. You know, you ask somebody, what do they say? Yeah, I understand, it makes sense, I understand, but if you can't say over, that means you don't really understand it fully. So he says you have to repeat it, and you should repeat what you learned without your notes. You have to learn it, take notes, what you learn, and then repeat. You know, put it in your head, say it out, say it over, say it out loud without notes. And then every 2 weeks, that's what he writes, every 2 weeks, go back and see if you can recall what you learned without the notes. Okay, maybe after 2 weeks, you have to look at your notes a little bit and you scan your notes and then you see. So that's a sort of a how to review. I always tell people it's very hard. Review is the most important thing of learning. If you want to learn, I mean, if you want to know, if you want to learn that Rav Zevin, the great Rav Zevin, Mo'adim Ba'alacha, and also passed away in the 70s, I believe, the founding, the visionary of Encyclopedia Talmudit. So Rav Zevin has an article, he has another book, not quite as well known, Or Halacha, all kinds of fascinating articles on halachic topics. He has halacha an article on Shylock, on snow and halacha, all kinds of fascinating topics. So he has an article on the difference between learning Torah and knowing Torah. There are two distinct mitzvot. There's a mitzvah to learn Torah. Daf Yomi is the best system in the world for learning Torah because that's a Say Torah Tchakva. It's every day. It's continuous. And thing for learning Torah, it's the greatest thing there is. For knowing Torah, it's one of the weakest things there is because it's unless you're going to spend 5 hours a day on Daf Yomi, which almost nobody does, understandably, you're not going to know it. You pick up a point two, great, but all right, it's very hard. There are two distinct mitzvot, and that's how Rav Zevin explains, like the Gemara in Menachot, I believe it is, says that how do you fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah? So we know there's the Hageta bo yomam v'layla, to learn Torah day and night, and some interpret it mamash, every free moment you have to learn Torah, and then there's other opinion that if you say Kriyat Shema, that's it. You say Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema is part of the Torah. So you say Kriyat Shema in the morning, Kriyat Shema in the evening. You've learned day and night. That's it. You fulfill your mitzvah. Obviously, Kol Hamarba raised them Mishubach. But Rav Zevin says that idea of Shema, that won't help you to know Torah. That's a discussion how to fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah. There's a mitzvah to learn Torah, to the mitzvah to know Torah. So that you have to review and spend lots of time and focus on subject and not distractions, have windows and nice books and et cetera, and say it out loud. That's to know Torah. But there's also most people that's maybe most people are not capable to know a little bit, of course. But I think for most people, especially as we adults, our mitzvah really is to learn Torah. Knowing Torah is nice, but the mitzvah is to learn Torah. I know it sounds a little bit funny. Obviously, we want to learn to know, but our focus is not so much we can't. There's so much to know, whatever. That's why that's the advantage of Daf Yomi. And the last thing he says is to go to places, you have to go to a place where you can, sort of like the first place, focus. Nobody's going to bother you. Nobody's going to disturb you. We know there's so many distractions to learn, and you have to sort of lock yourself in the library. And it's interesting where it's nice and quiet. It's interesting. We have this dual aspect, you know, learning out loud, noise, that's how you remember, but also quiet. And we all know that's true. Sometimes when you learn, you have to focus. You need absolute quiet. You need a library, you know, and nobody talks. And sometimes you need noise. You have to do out loud. Of course, those who learn in a Beit Midrash know the noise is sort of, you know, if you sit in a Beit Midrash and it's not noisy, like there's not a hum of noise, it's very hard to learn. If you can hear two people learning, if you hear 100 people, you don't hear anything. You just hear a hum of noise and you get used to it. I sometimes find that it's very, very, very difficult. I sit in the library at chat sometimes when I teach, writing, doing work, and sometimes I hum to myself and I have, okay, the library, there's not 100% quiet, but you know, I'm in a library, say a library, and I'm in a Beit Midrash, and a Beit Midrash, yeah, talk out loud. But we need both, sort of the library and the Beit Midrash, to learn. So those are just some of the ideas. I think a lot of them are kind of obvious, but it's kind of interesting how the Virgil spends out to say Torah tchakva, make your Torah permanent. It's to know Torah, to review Torah, to focus on Torah, and to learn Torah in a strategic way. In other words, well, it's not just enough to learn. Yeah, that's great, but you have to strategize. What's the best way to learn? And for most people, it probably is Daf Yomi, because most people without that push to learn Daf Yomi wouldn't find the time to learn an hour a day. That's the greatness. I just, you know, throwing that out as an example. But, you know, I don't have to tell you most Rabbanim and most Torah scholars don't learn Daf Yomi. Many were opposed to the idea. They found it kind of silly. Now they don't say that because we see how successful it is. But on a strategic point of view, if you want to develop into a great Torah scholar, you can't learn a page of Talmud. Maybe you can learn 2 pages. Maybe you can learn half a page. Depends how hard the page is. Some pages are 10 times harder. So like so there are different strategies, and there are two mitzvot to learn Torah and asei Torah tchakva, to make our Torah permanent, to make the Torah part of it. That was what Shammai says, asei Torah tchakva. Okay, let's move on to Mishnah Natet Zayin. Rabban Gamliel Omer, asei lecha rav, v'histalek min hasafek, v'al tarbel aser matut. Make for yourself a rabbi. We had this before. Histalek min hasafek. Remove any doubt. Remove yourself from doubt, so that the link is obvious. If you have a teacher, then you don't know what to do, so you ask your teacher. That's histalek min hasafek. But al tarbel laser umadut. So this is you're not allowed to estimate when you give true masrot. Really, when you give masrot, you can't estimate. What does that mean? So we know that a farmer has to, you know, the farmer has to give about 21%, you know, taxes, and some years only 11%. Or so. What does that mean? The farmer, of course, if you're not a farmer, it's a whole different system. But the farmer has to give bikurim. That's the first thing. That's what we call it on Shavuot, the first day to bring your first fruits to the temple. and only the Kohen can eat Bikurim. You have to give it to the Kohen. And the Mishnah says if you live far away, you brought dried fruits. You bring fresh fruit, they're not going to last the journey. So you bring raisins, whatever, you drink dried fruits. So Bikurim begins on Shavuot, goes till Sukkot or perhaps to Hanukkah, debate in the Mishnah. But that's the first thing the farmer has to get separate, but there's no amount. We say it every morning, HaPeyaba. Bikurim. So he has to give a little bit amount, but then he gets more serious. Of course, he has to leave leket shichacha and peyah. Okay, peyah has to leave the corner, also no amount. The rabbis suggest the Kohen, the farmer give 1/60. That's the rabbi's recommendation, 1/60 of the corner of the field for the poor. Leket and shichacha are, that's only if it happens. If you drop, in other words, if you don't drop things, you don't have to leave it. Of course, the idea is if you have so much that you can't carry it and you drop it, you don't need it. That's the idea of leket. You can't pick up what you drop. And if you trip, you know, there's whole different discussions how it falls. And the same thing on shichacha. If I forget to harvest one of my fields, I got to leave it for the poor. What does that mean? That's obvious. If you got 97 fields and you have a Swiss bank account, you can't remember your Swiss bank account or your accountant who knows where, you don't need that investment. You have so much, you don't need it. If you really needed it, you wouldn't forget about it. So if you got so much and you forgot it, you can do without it. Let the poor have it. They're really beautiful halachot in a way, the psychology of the halachot. So, and by the way, those halachot are written by the holiday of Shavuot. It's repeated. It's written in Kedoshim, and then again in Emor, we read it. I mean, those who read Torah at home, whatever, maybe in Israel, you can go to shul already. That's the last pasuk on Shavuot, tying Shavuot to the land, to Peah, to Leket. Okay, the farmer's got to give a little bit of that, and then he gives truma. How much truma does he to the Kohen? Only a Kohen can eat truma. How much does he have to give? Very little. Chita achat poter adekri, one grain. Again, the rabbis recommend 2%. Okay, then you've got, let's say, we'll start here, 100 bushels, 2% to the Kohen, got 98 left. So of the 98 left, you got to give 10% to the Levi. Interesting, my son asked you this week, why 5 times as much to the Levi to the Kohen? So I don't have a great answer to that. It's really 3 times as much because the Levi then has to give 10% to the Kohen. That's also a beautiful halacha. It's halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchot Staka. Even people on welfare have to give, you know, Yisaka. Maybe you have to give half a cent. They have to give a pruta. But whatever you have to give to others. You have to share a little bit. So you give 10% or 9.8%, if you want to be technical, to the Levi. And the Levi gives 10% of that Trumat Maser to the Kohen. The difference, of course, between Truma and Maser is only a Kohen can eat Truma or Truma Maser, and anybody can eat Maser. The Levi can go back and share it with you. The Kohen cannot share it with you. Can only share with the family. And then you've got, what do they have left? 88.2%, 9.3, right? 88.2% left, and you got to give another 10%, 8.8%. You got it, and I use these numbers in a Wednesday because that's exactly what the mission is saying. You have to be exact. When you give your maser, al tarbel aser umadot, you can't give more. Truma, you can give more. You have to give an exact amount. We'll explain why in a second. So you have to give 8.8%. So in years 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 of the Shemitah cycle, we have, of course, the 7-year Shemitah cycle. Year 7 doesn't apply because it feels hefker for everybody. You take your produce to Jerusalem and you spend it on the meat and wine and other things. And you have to. And if it's too much, you don't want to schlep all your produce. So you can redeem it. You add 25%, what the Torah calls a fifth, but it's really a quarter. Because what the Torah calls a fifth, it's a fifth milah blar. In other words, if you have 100, and you add a quarter, 125, so the 25 is 1/5. That's how the Mishnah does math. It's not wrong or right. It's just, we don't do it like that. It's the convention of the Mishnah. When they say a fifth, they mean that the added part is a fifth of the total. So that's what we call a quarter. So you got to add a quarter, and then you have to spend the money in Yerushalayim. So that's, but you eat it yourself. It's yours. You have to give it away. But a lot of people come to Yerushalayim, it's important, Jews come and see and spend money. Jerusalem doesn't have industry, it's a capital city, it's got learning, civil servants, so you need to promote the economy. That's what that's part of the reason. Have to promote, people will spend money in Yerushalayim. So that's Maser Sheni. In years 3 and 6, you give to the poor. give to the poor. Anyway, the halacha is, that was a review for some people or new, just to understand the system, how the Torah system for farmers. Of course, non-farmers don't have that system, so we have staka. In a sense, it's a parallel system. Staka applies to all our money. These were specific halachas to farming. The Torah always talked about farmers, so many halachas of farmers, because that's what was relevant. The Torah spoke about what was relevant. They didn't speak about cars because they didn't have cars. We would know what cars went. The Torah spoke about what was meaningful to those people. So they're not going to talk about industry and commerce and things like that. They didn't have so much of that. So they had to talk about this farming, and that's the job of to apply the values in farming to other aspects of life. Leket shichapeh, how does that apply in the law office? Whatever. So that's what we have to do. But so you have to give an exact amount. That's what the Mishnah says, and that's also connected to having a rabbi. Why it's important? Because if you give the wrong amount, then it's not really maser. It's a combination of maser and tevel. You're not clear what it is. In other words, you're not allowed to declare something maser that isn't. If you give too much, you mess up the whole system. Al tarbeh laser medud. And the commentaries explain, v'histalek mean hasafek, remove yourself from doubt. So Tiferet Yisrael says this. He says, what do I do? I'm not sure how much I have to give in maser. I don't know exactly. So I'll give the levy more. I'm really religious. I really care about the mitzvah of the Torah. So I'm going to give more than I have to give. So Mishnah says, no. Sometimes when you give more, you're giving less. You're doing less. They said this is the, and then he develops this. It's not just in Maser, in all types. You're not allowed to do a chumrah. You shouldn't be strict. You shouldn't be strict because I'm not sure what the law is. So I'm going to be strict. Because he says, usually when that happens, you're usually lenient in somewhere else. People, it's like, it's not like you're strict here. Everything is interconnected. So if you're very strict on, say I've mentioned before, I don't know why, if you're very strict on going to Minyan in the morning, so you're a little bit lenient on helping out in the house, you're leaving the house. If you're strict on everything has a counterbalance. So just to be strict, that's wrong. That's why the Mishnah says it. Histalik min hasafek. But al tarbeh laser medut. You can't just do whatever you want. I'll be strict. And he quotes the most famous example of this by, I think, what's it on the next mission too, but it really connects here. By Chava, God said, don't eat from the fruit. And she said, don't touch it. And that was wrong. That's not what God said. And that's, very famous, the Rambam and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, on the Rambam that... you're not allowed to say a rabbinic law is a biblical law. You can say, or if the rabbis have a good reason, they can add to the Torah, so to speak. They can say chicken and milk is forbidden. If they don't have a good reason, it's forbidden. It's adding to the Torah. What's the balance? Saying halal on Yom HaTzmut, is that adding to the Torah? Or is that, no, that's great. That you're just extending the concept of the Torah. I don't know if that's a great example, but you get the point. The rabbis... but if you claim a rabbinic law is a biblical law, that's a terrible thing that you're not allowed to do. That's baltos. You have to make it clear. So there's room to be machmir. There's room to be machmir, but only if you know what you're doing. And if you know why you're being machmir, to be machmir, to be strict, just to remove yourself from doubt, usually you're going to make a mistake. So that's how they explain the three ideas in the Mishnah. Now, Aselech HaRav, we already had this. We already had Aselech HaRav earlier in the Mishnah. So some say there are two different reasons. I don't know if we mentioned that at the time. The first Aselech HaRav, back Yeshua ben Prach Yomer, make yourself a rabbi. That's for learning. You have to have teachers. This Aselech HaRav, and there the commentary is saying it's not good to have only one teacher. You want to have different perspectives. You want to don't always learn from one teacher. Get different viewpoints. There's also debate how that works, but basically you want to be exposed to different ideas, and then you see what works for you. Here, a Aselech HaRav is talking about a posek. You need someone. You're in doubt with questions. It's one thing to learn ideas, but practicalities. You need one authority to go to. It's hard today to have one authority. We are. Subspecialties. It's next to impossible for one rabbi to know everything. It's impossible. So even in Psak Halacha, even in Gedolim, you have great, great Torah sages, and they're expert in certain areas. As a matter of fact, it's very funny. I think it was Ari Berman, President Wayu, when I was watching the eulogies for Dr. Lam. So they mentioned that when Dr. Lam became rabbi of the Jewish Center in 1959, so there was a whole controversy in the Manhattan Erev. By the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein is such a beautiful Jewish. He's such a great posik. Rav Moshe was asked by somebody, can they give money? There was a fundraising campaign for the Manhattan Erev. And this person wasn't caring. What should he do about it? Should he protest? So Rav Moshe wrote, listen, I don't remember the exact language, but it's a beautiful tshuva. It's short. It says, I think you can't build an Erev in Manhattan. It's Rishut HaRavim. You cannot build an Erev in Manhattan. But, there are other rabbis. I'm not the only rabbi in town. And other rabbis are allowed to disagree, and they have what to rely on, and therefore there's nothing wrong with having an Erev in Manhattan, and there can be a campaign, if the shul has a campaign, that's fine. I forget if he told him he should actually give to the campaign, then I can't remember if he told him give to the campaign, even though you think the Erev is invalid, because the community, it's good for the community. Anyway, that's Rav Moshe. So Rabbi Lam, I guess, wasn't sure, so he went to speak to Rav Soloveitchik, his teacher, and he asked him about the Erev. Rav Soloveitchik said to him, it's like a funny, it's like how Nechama Leibowitz told us, she doesn't know Megillat Esther. We asked her to give us a class on Megillat Esther. So Nechama Leibowitz said, I don't know Megillat Esther. Well, I can't teach. Yeah, right. So Rav Soloveitchik said, I don't know Hilchot Erevin so well. I'm not expert in Hilchot Erevin. You study the subject. I gave you smicha. And if you think the Erev is good, that's good. That's fine. You decide. You're the rabbi. You're the maradatra. So Rabbi Lam, he studied the subject, whatever, and he felt it was okay, and he encouraged the people in the shul, he allowed them to use the Erev. And then a number of years later, the Rav Soloveitchik came out, and he said, I guess he studied the subject more, whatever, and he was against it. He didn't think you could shit carry in Manhattan. So Dr. Lam went back to him, and he said, okay, do I have to change? And Rav Soloveitchik said, of course not. You're entitled to your opinion. It's just, what you feel is right. And that's from Hamidu Talmidim Harbe that we spoke about in the first class. That's what they were talking about. In other words, you have to, on your own, you have to have a rabbi for Psak Halacha, one rabbi, one authority, but that rabbi can't know everything. They're going to have, you have experts in Hilchot Erevin. And you have, I think Howard Schachter goes around and he builds Erevin a lot, if I'm not mistaken. Different people. They now have a new Manhattan Erev. Rav Schachter, I think, is the Rav HaMachshir of the Manhattan Erev. You have to have in the experts in Hilchot Kashrut and Mikvah and business ethics, etc., etc. So this Asei Lecha, there's an Asei Lecha Rav, a teacher, and there's a Asei Lecha Rav, a posek. But some of the commentaries say here is this Asei Lecha Rav, interesting, is talking about a city rabbi. You have to have an individual, or it's Yeshua ben Prakhet, it doesn't really matter which, is talking about a city has to have a rabbi. That's all in Europe. You have rabbis of shuls. First of all, many communities were very small. They didn't have shuls. I mean, they had one shul, two shuls. And of course, you couldn't open up a shul in Europe. You needed the permission of the community to open up a shul. You can't. Rav Moshe has a lot of tshuvas against breakaway minyanim. You shouldn't read them, people, because it would destroy half of America is built on breakaway shuls. This one from here. Rav Moshe is very much against those. You have one minyan for everybody. That's just, you have to have a shul. Everybody have to build a community. You want to have a shul a block away from another shul. Yeah, if it's a half an hour walk, so you build another shul. So a lot of the towns were very small. So, but the rabbis were rabbis of cities. The Nodeh Yehuda was the rabbi of Prague. Go to Prague, there's a shul here, a shul there. He's the rabbi of both shuls, so to speak. And that used to be the old minhag. Every city would hire a rabbi, and that was great prestige to the shul. And then you have an individual posek. I mentioned before, when Brisk hired Rav Chaim Soloveitchik as the rabbi, so Rav Chaim Soloveitchik agreed to the position on condition he doesn't speak and he doesn't paskin shilas. That's not what he does. He's a theoretician. He teaches like Rav Soloveitchik. I don't know Hilchot Erevin. I teach Erevin conceptually, but that was the whole Brisker Derech. They divorced Psak from learning. It's a little bit, now it's not controversial because everybody does it, but it was a The Chazon Ish didn't like it at all. Many other people didn't like it. But that's the Brisker way. It's a conceptual, theoretical, learning ideas. Psak Halach is like a car mechanic. You know, you need somebody to fix it and know what to do. That's really how they viewed it. Read Rav Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. And you'll see sort of, I don't want, disdain is a hard word, but it's a little bit sort of looking down. I just answer Shailas on Kashrut. Rav Chaim took the pots and pans and he made it into ideas. That's how the Rav talks. But the bottom line is the pots and pans are pots and pans. And you have to know if the Milchik pot and the Fleischik pot can make, you have to know what to do. It's a very nice conception. But anyways, that was the, so Rav Chaim said, I'll be a rabbi, but I'm not going to Paskin Shailas. Hire Rav Simcha Rieger. We'll hire a Posek Yisra. I don't speak. Hire a Magid. Okay, I said before, can you imagine a rabbi today gets hired by a shul, they pay him even not a big salary, pay him $80,000 a year. What do they pay him? And they say, you know, I'm not going to answer questions. That's not my role. And I'm not going to speak. I don't speak, not even on Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuvah. That's insane. So why do they hire him? Why do they hire him? Rav Chaim Brisker to the rabbi of the shul of the city? Wow. That great, tremendous honor to the city. But there is a Selech HaRav here, a posek. Okay. Now, okay, that's enough on that Mishnah. Let's try to finish quickly. Shimon ben Noam, I'm sorry. Okay, by the one that Rabban Gamliel Omer. So by the way, I forgot to mention, Rabban Gamliel, this is in a sense a transitional Mishnah. Remember the last, like 10 Mishnayos have been the pairs, Yeshua ben Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan, Nitai Abrali, Yeshua ben Prakish, Shmai and Atalion, Hillel and Shammai. You have the five generations of Zugot, we call them, the dual leadership of the Jewish people, where you had a Nasi and an Abbeitin. By Rabban Gamliel, now we're talking around 60, 70 years or so before the temple is destroyed. Rabban Gamliel Hazaken, he's not referred to as Hazaken in this Mishnah, but it's clear that it's Rabban Gamliel Hazaken and Rabban Gamliel the Yavna. Rabban Gamliel, his grandson, in the famous Rabban Gamliel, you know, at the Pesach Seder and arguing with Rabbi Yeshua, that's the Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. So at this point, we move from a dual leadership to a single leadership. Rabban Gamliel is the Nasi. He's the final authority, and therefore when he says to Rabbi Yeshua, you come to me because I think your calendar is wrong, and you have to do what you have to do, I don't care that you think it's Yom Kippur. We can't have a split in Jewish community. Rabbi Yeshua goes, and Rabban Gamliel, hey, maybe he's a little harsh, but he's the Nasi. Otherwise, there's anarchy. And of course, it probably ties in as, you know, the temple's destroyed. You need more, I got a strong leadership, you need one leader. But it's interesting that the Tosfot Yomtiv, who lived in Prague, Yomtiv Lipman Heller, was the rabbi in Prague after the Maharal. So the Tosfot Yomtiv quotes an explanation. He actually doesn't agree with this explanation. He says, I think it's so fascinating. If you notice, when you're learning Mish, it's always Kiblu Mehem, Kiblu Mehem. You know, Hillel and Shammai Kiblu Mehem. They received the tradition from them, from the previous person. Every, right, remember Perkei Avot, the first Perek for sure, is just passing down the Masorah, our tradition generation. It's a historical development of our tradition. And therefore, this Antiknos Isoko, you know, Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the Anshei Knesset Gdola. Antiknos Isoko learned from him, and Yossi ben Yoezer Kiblu Mehem, etc. By Rabban Gamliel, you don't have Kiblu Mehem anymore. The Mishnah should have said Rabban Gamliel Kiblu or Kibel. Rabban Gamliel is very fascinating, even though he's descendant, a child or a grandson, I think there's some debate, of Hillel. The family of Rabban Gamliel often followed the rulings of Beit Shammai. And you have very often in the Mishnah, Rabban Gamliel would quote, our family used to follow this tradition of Shammai. And the rabbi said, it's very nice, your family can do what they want, but for the Jewish people, we follow Hillel. And it was Rabban Gamliel who, by the way, established the halacha as Beit Hillel. But it doesn't say Kiblu Mehem. Why not? Or he to receive him. So the Tosfot Yomtiv quotes, we spoke about the idea of Machloket a few weeks ago, argument. He says, you know, the Gemara says that in the generation of after Hillel and Shammai, that's Hirbat Torah Machloket B'Israel. That's when the fighting started, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And there was one Gemara we discussed, a very negative view of this. Shloshim Shu Kotzorcham, they didn't study Torah. They didn't pay attention fully. They didn't make Torah so permanent. So this one, so this, this. The Machloka paid Hillel Naset Torah Kishtei Torah. The Torah became like two Torah. That's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So the Tosfos Yontif quotes, you no longer have one source of Torah. Up till the generation of Hillel and Shammai, there was a clear line of Torah. We know who the leaders are. Once you get to the generation of Rabban Gamliel, it's Hefkeres. It's this one learned from he learned from there. Everybody's learning from somewhere else. This one argues here, this one argues there. We know Hillel and Shammai only have three arguments, three halakhic arguments. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai had over 300 arguments. That's a pretty big gap. 100 times more in one generation. So you no longer have the notion of Kivlu Mehem. I find that such an interesting, actually, he doesn't agree for whatever, and he says later on, you have Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, Kivel Mehillel. But of course, you know, when a commentary quotes an opinion, then he says, I don't agree with it, it means it's worthy of note. By the way, there are some who explained, very also fascinating, I'll say that, we always understand Kivlu Mehem. They received the tradition from the earlier person. I forget who, but one of the Mefarshim says Kivlu Mehem might be a reference. It doesn't really fit so well with the Pshat, but it's also a beautiful idea. Kivlu Mehem is the Jewish people. Hillel and Shammai Kivlu Mehem. In other words, the people Kivlu Mehem. We, the people, accepted the Torah from Hillel and Shammai. And we know that that's... the Torah has to be, you know, you can say what you want, but if your students don't accept it, it really doesn't mean very much. There's a willingness, and we know that a rabbinic law only takes effect if the people willingly accept it. And by the way, you cannot force yourself. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great, great posek that he was, read his beautiful introduction to the Igros Moshe. So what he writes in the Igros Moshe, his introduction, among other things, that, you know, here's my opinion. If you agree with it, very nice. And if you don't agree with it, that's fine. People ask me questions. Nobody has to agree with what I write. That's why I write. I tell you my opinion. I give you my arguments. Why yes, why no. And you can disagree with me. Bevakasha. I'm not telling you. And that's the classical rabbinic tradition is... a student can't. We don't have, when you have a Sanhedrin, it's different. We don't have a Sanhedrin. A Selech HaRav, you choose your rabbi. A Selech HaRav, you have to choose your rabbi and accept them, fine. But I don't have to accept just because Rav Moshe Feinstein says something. Very nice. It's not, you know, that some posek says something. It's very nice. You may not be related to have nothing to do with them. I mentioned this to you, Rav Soloveitchik goes a step further, really ties into a Say Torah Chakva, make your Torah permanent. You have to go over it, review it, know it. You can say it over without notes. Even so, Rav Soloveitchik said that it's not Rav, I'm sure other people he's getting it, but I heard in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, then I think Rav Chaim of Elashin, the Soloveitchik tradition from the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim of Elashin, Rav Chaim married the granddaughter of the Netziv, and the Netziv married the granddaughter of Rav Chaim of Elashin. So Rav Soloveitchik said, you know, if a rabbi gives you a psak halach and you don't understand it, you're not allowed to accept it. In other words, it's not like I call up the rabbi, yes or no. That's normally not how it works, even though you have to understand what the rabbi says. And if the rabbi's position, psak halacha makes no sense to you. I assume we're talking about people who are somewhat learned. We're not, I imagine, for the people who know nothing. Okay, what do I mean? That doesn't make sense to them. Okay, that's clear. But someone, you don't have to be on the level of the rabbi, but to someone who's what we call like a bar hachi, he knows a little bit, he can understand. And the rabbi's reasoning just doesn't make sense. So you know what? That's not a psak halacha. You know, the rabbi said, people do this all the time. The rabbi says it's kosher. I don't understand why, it makes no sense. I know some information makes no sense. But the rabbi said it's kosher. No problem, eat it. Can't do that. And the same thing, the rabbi says it's, you know, treif. What do you mean it's treif? What's he talking about? So also, you know, that's, you know, you're not bound by that. So there has to be a selech harav. Yistalek min hasapek. In other words, you only ask a rabbi if you have a sapek. Yistalek min hasapek. A selech harav, but if there's no doubt, you don't have to ask. And that's what the Torah says even when there's a Sanhedrin, the issue of a zakein mamre, rebellious elder, Torah says, ki palemim chadavar. If something is wondrous to you, you don't know what the law is, then v'kamta balita, then you go up and you ask. But if you know what the law is, you don't have to ask. I'll say, man, I don't know why I should say this sort of, you know, I feel like this part of a a nice community I try to create on Zoom so people know me or maybe my idiosyncrasies and whatever. So this morning I was taking out the garbage a little bit. So I don't know why it popped into my mind. So I don't have a mezuzah on our garage. I know most Jews today have a mezuzah in their garage. I don't have a mezuzah in our garage because if you walked into our garage, you wouldn't want to stay there very long. You know, what do we put in the garage? Our garbage. That's what we put there, garbage and junk. Now nobody has a mezuzah on a washroom because obviously how can you have a mezuzah in a washroom? Now, the truth of the matter is today, yeah, the washrooms of the Talmud, the outhouse, yeah, don't have a mezuzah. The washrooms of today, 98% of the time, are you kidding? I don't want to say the old jokes, you know, but the washrooms are very nice. People spend a lot of money to make a nice bath. It's a very nice room. My bathroom is way nicer than our garage. And I would put a mezuzah on my garage, on my bathroom 50 times before I would put it on the garage. I don't have a bathroom either, but the garage. So why don't I ask somebody? I'm just saying maybe because I don't have a safek. I know. In other words, I'm not in doubt that, and I feel maybe a thing of who am I that's a little bit arrogant. Okay, I hope not. But on big issues, I don't have a doubt it's meaningless. On Hilchot Mezuzah, on a garage, I don't think I have to ask a rabbi. So maybe it's a silly example, but I just use that. But that's really classical rabbinic stuff. If you don't have a safek. Now, problem is, many people don't know what they don't know. That's right. It's always hard. But you only have to ask a shayla. This idea of asking, you know, a shayla in every little thing, you know, don't waste the postage time. Like, I have to nourish it. That's another greatness of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I'll just say, in the tshuva, some woman called him up and he writes, it was like Parshat Lech Lecha in New York. You know, I guess maybe a little bit later after we had changed the clock, and it was left benching was at 4:10, and the woman from his building on the Lower East Side writes to Rakaza Rav Moshe Rabbi Feinstein. I'm sure you know didn't know exactly who Rav Moshe was, a nice probably Jewish lady, but not fully understanding the greatness of Rav Moshe. Said Rabbi Feinstein, I don't understand. It says on my calendar that candle lighting's at 4:10, and I saw you went in the car to go to synagogue at 4:12. How can you go to synagogue after the beginning of Shabbat? So, of course, we all know you have 18 minutes. And we all know that the men, especially, they drive to shul after the 18 minutes. So Rav Moshe explained, and he said, you know what? I don't want anybody to think wrong. And he took it upon himself. He's never going to go. He's never going to go in a car again after the left benching time. So that's interesting. You know, some people have a suffix on left benching time. Some people don't know enough to understand what it means to light candles. Other people, their suffix is on a much higher level. So every person on their own asks the questions that are relevant to them. But for many people, that's a silly question to ask. But anyways, you got to know. Okay. Shimon ben Omer. So Shimon, the son of Rabban Gamliel, and that's why is he called Shimon and not Rab Shimon ben Gamliel? Because he was young, probably wasn't a rabbi like Ben Azai, Ben Zoma. You have that later, Ben Zakkai. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is occasionally referred to Ben Zakkai. Means what he said, his teaching was said when he was a young, precocious student. And he had a brilliant insight, but he was a rabbi yet. He was very young. So Shimon ben Omer, you say, Kol Yama Galdalti ben Chachamim. My entire days, I grew up among great sages. He lived in the house of Rabban Gamliel, right? You grew up in the house of Rav Soloveitchik. You grew up in the house of Moshe Feinstein. Those people are very lucky. You grew up in wonder in families that you're exposed to people and learning. And, Beitcha, Beitvat, the Chachamim. The Lo Matzati Leguf Tov Elishtika. And I find the best thing for Leguf, for my body, not for my spirit, is to shut up. Keep your mouth shut. When you're in the presence of great people, what are you talking about? You're a little kid. Listen, two ears, one mouth. So it's better to be quiet. Don't show what a fool you are by speaking. I don't mean to be so harsh, but we all know that. You know, if you stay quiet, nobody will know what you don't know. That's a big problem in adult education, which isn't good. Adults very often are very afraid. You'll ask questions like on Zoom. Adults are often afraid to answer because they're afraid they may not know and they're embarrassed a little. Shouldn't be embarrassed. It's fine, everybody, you know, but that's it. Kids don't have that embarrassment. You know, kids are kids. They say what's on their mind. So, but there is. So it's only laguf, it's only for body matters, but I mean, but you have to know when to be quiet and whose presence you should speak and who you shouldn't. The Bartanura, that's not how he explains it. I'm not saying he disagrees with this, but that's not what he explained. He says, what I mean is good to be quiet means when people insult you. Laguf taught people are yelling, what an idiot you are. I mentioned Dr. Lam at the beginning. So, you know how much, right? Yeah, you know, how many people yelled at him and told him he's an apikoros, and this and that. People didn't like it. Whenever you stand up strongly for a position, one that not everybody accepts, Torah Mada, not everybody liked that idea. And the way Dr. Lam presented it, lots of people said all kinds of terrible things about him and all kinds of things. But no, yeah, a person with strong sin, it's okay. You don't answer. He was very nice, and it's well known. I mentioned the other day, not that they're saying they yelled him, but it was Dr. Lam, I think, who made the shidduch. This is what I understand between Art Scroll and Schottenstein. So if you think about Daf Yomi, Norman Lam gets all the credit. That's that. In other words, Art Scroll apparently was running out of money. And I guess YU, that's, I had heard this story that whatever, the Marsco came with the idea of the Talmud, it's very expensive. And Norman Lamb made the Shidduch, the Schottenstein family in Art Scroll. And of course, the rest is history. The people, there are hundreds of thousands of people learned Daf Yomi because of the Schottenstein family. Because with the English translation of the Talmud, that's what put it on the map. And I'm not saying the Tetra, but that wasn't the Aguda and the YU weren't exactly the same wavelength on everything. But so a great person is willing to take abuse. Sometimes you have to respond when for certain things, but not on a personal level. Sometimes you respond ideologically, but not on a personal level. And that's how the Bartanura explains. People are willing to take it, you're much better off. If you have to respond to every criticism, life is hard. Life is hard. Let it slide. It's okay. Let people say what they want to say. So that's how he interprets Lomatzati Guftov Elishtikan here, but Loha Medrish Hua Ikar. It's also the same idea that explains not speaking. Speaking is not important. That's, again, the link between the two ideas, even though really two different ideas. Loha Midrash Elikar, not like speaking, even in Torah. That's, I think, the Tiferet Yisrael explained. In other words, I found my Guftov for my body, my physical, don't speak so much. And even in the world of Torah, Loha Midrash. Not saying is important, not learning Torah even, Hamasa. More important than the study, Midrash, is action. We spoke before, say Torah Tchakva, right? But more important, the law of Midrash, Hua Ikar Ala Hamasa. And this is actually interesting. Of course, well, why do we study Torah? It's not a theoretical field. It's not an academic subject. It may also be an academic subject, but it's we study it. It's a Torah Chaim, so we'll know how to observe it. Many of you may know, the question is, does he disagree with the Gemara in Kiddushin? I don't think he does. The Gemara in Kiddushin quotes, I think it was actually Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, but I have to double check now. The Gemara in Kiddushin quotes a machloket, what's more important, learning or doing? Talmud or Masa? Talmud, and the Gemara said they argued, I think, for 3 years, and they reached a conclusion. What's better? Talmud is better. Learning is better. Huh? Disagrees. Why is learning better? She said, Talmud may be lide masa. It's like a funny answer. Learning is better than, more important than action, because learning leads to action. Really, action is better. But the way to get to action is to learn. It's not always true anymore. Maybe it was. In other words, the more you learn, the more you'll do, the more you'll act. It's true to a large extent, but it's not 100% true. But the idea is that we learn Torah, the more we learn, and what we have to do, the more we'll do. Talmud is more important than David Masa. I remember when I was in yeshiva, you know, in Israel. So I don't know, one of my friends asked one of the Rebbeim, Rav Nevensol, I think it was. I was in yeshiva. Got the Rebbe Victor Nevensol, the Rebbe of the Old City, now he's quite famous. You know, he's a tzaddik, really a total tzaddik. Anyway, so he asked him, I think it was Rebbe Nevensol, should he learn? He only has an hour a day to learn. What should he learn? Like the Daf Yomi, you only have an hour a day to learn. What are you going to learn? So he says, I'm going to learn, should I learn, you know, Musar, how to be a better person? Or should I learn like Halacha, Gemara, something? So if I remember correctly, Rav Nevensol still told him, you should learn Musar. Because if you learn Musar, you'll realize you have more than an hour a day to learn. So, you know, if you learn Torah, yeah, Torah is more important than action. Because if you learn Torah, you'll do more. You'll do more action. It's like, you know, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein apparently used to say that I think in the early years, maybe he really, you know, he says, you know, people go to university from yeshiva, they can't learn this, you know, in yeshiva, they can learn 10, 12, 15 hours a day, some people. And they go to university, he went to Harvard, and it's hard to learn. So he said, the way I heard the story is he said, I don't understand. When I was in Harvard, I learned 6 hours a day. You know, okay, most people are not Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. They can't go to Harvard and learn 6 hours a day. The story, when I heard Rav Avishai David, who was in Toronto for years and now in Israel, when I heard him give a eulogy, Hesped for Rav Aaron, so the way Rabbi David presented the story is that Rav Aaron said, when he was in Harvard, he learned 10 hours a day. He did university 4 hours a day, whatever, and he studied Torah 10 hours a day in Harvard. No, not so many people can do that, but not so many people can be Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Okay, you have to know who you are. You have to know it's okay. Everybody at their level. Lo midrash yikar ala maseh v'chol amar v'dvarim may be chet. Whoever saw the law does sin. Okay, it's one more mission to go, but I see it's 10:26, so let me just do a quick review of what we learned, and then wish everybody a wonderful Shabbat. Okay, so we started with the Tiferet Yisrael's five-pronged explanation on the Say Torah Kakva, make your Torah permanent. To focus on learning, it's not like you relax and, you know, you sort of you in and out, you know, with you have got to focus. You have to have a nice place to learn, good books. You have to do it continuous, not too many topics, not scattered all over the place. You got to make sure you know it, you understand it, and you got to make place nobody's going to bother you. You have to say it out loud, sing it, etc. Then we move to Rabban Gamliel, the transfer from our dual leadership to one leadership. You have to have a rabbi. There's rabbis for teachings. There's a rabbi for individual guidance for Pesach Halach, and there's a rabbi of a city. The rabbi brings honor to the city, different types of roles of the rabbi. The rabbi, of course, helps you remove doubt. So when you have doubt, you ask. If you don't have doubt, you don't ask. And then often, very often, you can't just be strict. Okay, I have a doubt, I'll do this. Because often the being strict leads to being lenient in some other area. Therefore, the Mishnah says you have to be very exact. When you give your truman and masrot and your masrot, you have to very give it exacting, and then we had the Shimon ben Gamliel to be quiet, even when people perhaps are insulting you. The relationship between learning and doing, of course, the goal is to do, and the method to get there is to learn. And don't talk too much. Kol amar b'dvarim may b'chei. Okay. We'll stop here. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Be well, be healthy. Sunday morning, Rabbi Adam Mintz is starting a new series on portraits in American history. He's talking, I believe, on the first Heter Agunot given in America. Of course, the famous postdoc for Heter Agunot is Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who Yeshiva University reached. His name is after Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, because Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, I believe, died in 1894. And Reach was established in 1896, I believe. That's why. So they named it for Rabbi Yitzchak. He had nothing to do. It's not like Albert Einstein, who gave his name to the medical school. Rabbi Yitzchak didn't know about Yeshiva University, but out of honor, they named it in his honor. Anyways, he'll be speaking on that on Monday. Menachem Liptag is starting a new series on the contradictions between Bamidbar and Dvarim. And on Tuesday, Marty Lakshin is starting a new series on Tamei HaMitzvot, and Nechama Price on Wednesday, and Naomi Seidman on Beis Yaakov Movement, History of Beis Yaakov Movement, the Parsha Shir, etc. Follow your emails. If you miss a class, we do have, you can always listen later. And I want to wish everybody well, and thank you, and Shabbat Shalom, and be healthy. We should see each other for good occasions. All right, let's just see quickly if there was any questions here. I'm sorry because I missed 1 week. What would you say? You could only give masers you seek because of the shrinkage in storage. What you eat good animals. Yeah. Exempt. What you sell. Oh, you gave maser, right? When you brought the maser, no, the truma of the maser didn't have to be brought to the Kohen, only to the Beit HaMikdash. Only Bikurim had to be brought to the Beit HaMikdash. So the truma maser you gave to the Kohen Levi was in your neighbor. You could give to whatever Kohen or Levi you want. There was no, you could choose. It's also maybe it wasn't always distributed 100% equitably. Okay. Anyways, thank you very much.